Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to start off just up the street, about a mile north of the World Trade Center, at the Trump Soho. The building launched at a pivotal moment for Donald Trump. 2006 was not a good year for him at all. He had lost control of his casinos, and he wasn't really building a lot. Trump was becoming more of a branding enterprise. But in the spring of 2006, on the season finale of The Apprentice, he makes a big announcement.
Located in the center of Manhattan's chic artist enclave, the Trump International Hotel and Tower.
His first building in New York in years. The Trump Soho was going to be 43 stories in Lower Manhattan, not exactly in Soho, as a matter of fact, but close enough. Donald Jr. and his sister Ivanka had signed papers incorporating as Dunka Soho to develop the property.
Never before us had there been a building that fit aesthetically within the downtown environment.
For zoning reasons, though, this wasn't the usual luxury tower. It was a strange hybrid of hotel and condo, and it turned out to be a tough sell at nearly $2 million a pop. And they were trying to sell it just as the financial crash hit. I'm going to let staff writer Adam Davidson, who's reported extensively on Trump's businesses, take us back to 2006 and explain precisely what happened.
So the Trump Soho, this is not just another project for Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. This is not just one more and dozens of projects. This is crucial. This is when the Donald Trump, as public figure, as famous New York real estate developer, as brand, has never been more famous, more heralded. And it's when Donald Trump, as actual developer, has never been less successful. His big play in casinos is crumbling right at that time. He's lost, by this point, majority ownership of his casino business, and the casinos themselves would all close in their third and final bankruptcy just a few years later. Trump Soho is his first major project, high-profile project in Manhattan in many years. He needs this thing to succeed. The stakes are really high.
And the stakes are actually even higher because...
Oh, wait, let me introduce you. This is Andrea Bernstein from WNYC.
So the stakes are even higher because for the first time, he's bringing his children, Ivanka and Don Jr., in on a project in a big way. So their names are on the documents underlying the building. And at the same time, Ivanka Trump, in particular, is becoming a TV star herself. She is becoming a personality on The Apprentice. So all of that is happening. It's not just a high-stakes project for Donald Trump. It's a high-stakes project for the Trump family.
For the next generation. And I should say, Andrea Bernstein, you are talking to us because you, along with Jesse Eisinger. Hi, Jesse.
Hello. How are you?
How are you? You are star reporter at ProPublica.
Yes, I like that.
All right. You are an okay reporter at ProPublica.
Sure.
Okay.
You're somebody.
And headlines in the New York Post, Daily News, and who knows where else saying Trump's latest building a flop. This would be disastrous.
Absolutely. And in fact, pretty quickly, it turns out that it is a flop. It's a project that is very difficult to sell, almost impossible to sell. It's downtown in Manhattan, which and fancy condos, which should be an attractive proposition, except that the zoning laws prohibit actual condos to be built in this part of what they're calling Soho, which isn't really Soho. It's right next to the exhaust-filled Holland Tunnel. And so they have to sell a kind of condo slash hotel room where you're only allowed to stay in it for 120 days a year, and you get to change nothing about the room. So essentially, you have a hotel room.
Great. Let's hear from Rudy Sieber. He was one of the brokers who was trying to sell it, and you spoke with him.
The units were quite small, very small, actually. It had a not even kitchenette. Basically, you only had a sink and a microwave. That was it. You had insane carrying charges, and also
all right,
would not
so
be able to.
Weird proposition, not selling well, stakes are huge. How is it going?
Badly. It's going badly. But the Trumps and their brokers are saying it's going really well. The Trumps start to say there's 31% sold. And then their brokers say it's 53% sold. And then Ivanka Trump and Eric Trump and Donald Jr. hold a press conference in 2008 for the foreign press. And they talk about how great it's going. And Ivanka Trump says 60% of the units are sold. 60%. But we know from a sworn affidavit that one of the other partners filed later with the Attorney General's office that there were actually not even 15% sold.
Why say anything at all? Why not just tout the benefits? We have a great gym. We have, you know, the restaurant's amazing.
Are you familiar with the Trumps?
Yeah.
Because of the thing that you said, Adam, the stakes were really high. This building had to succeed. It could not fail. And it was in a terrible economic market. And what we were told is that potential buyers are in fact bringing this up all the time. This is what Rudy Sieber, the broker, told us.
Every client is always going to ask, how well has the building sold? Why? Because they want to have the certainty that they're not the only ones that are, you know, dumb enough to want to buy.
So a civil suit is filed by some of the buyers who have researched the Trump statements. They've researched the affidavit, and they are accusing the Trumps and their business partners in the Trump Soho of a consistent pattern of outright lies.
And that's a quote from the lawsuit.
Correct. And then the DA's office sees this in the paper, and they start an investigation.
All right, so this is a big moment. I mean, a civil suit, New York real estate, there's probably 1,000 civil suits a day. The Trumps, the Trumps are sued constantly. But a criminal complaint, explain that. How could this be criminal?
Right, so this is the Manhattan DA opening up a criminal investigation into the Trump Organization. And, of course, crimes are more serious than civil suits and more serious than civil complaints from the government. You can go to prison.
It's also worth saying that Donald Trump has been involved in 4,000 civil lawsuits, according to USA Today, but not charged with a crime. His family not charged with a crime. So this would be a significant turn for the Trumps.
So they start this investigation more or less right when the civil lawsuit is filed in August 2010. And they have a very serious investigation that goes on for a while and starts to focus in on Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr.
So we ended up talking to 20 people who knew about the case. And in particular, 7 people who had seen email evidence of what the Trump children had said, and from what they told us, made the prosecution believe that there might be some very serious crimes committed by the Trumps, including fraud and larceny.
And the essence of the emails were that they appeared to prosecutors to show intent, that they knew that they were lying and did it anyway.
So these prosecutors have these emails. Walk me through what the next steps are.
Sure. So these investigations go slowly and carefully. And the Trumps assemble a high-powered defense team made up of 2 well-known criminal defense lawyers, Gary Naftalis of Kramer Levin and Paul Grand of Morvillo Abramowitz.
Who is the son-in-law of the former district attorney, Robert Morgenthau, very famous, and the former law partner of the current district attorney. So that is the caliber of the legal team that the Trumps have.
Exactly. And Grand is representing one of the brokers, and they start to have a series of meetings with the prosecutors to make their case. And the defense essentially is, well, we didn't really lie in a significant or material way. This was puffery.
Puffery.
And puffery is a legal term. Puffery.
That is, really?
Yeah. Puffery is a legal term.
As we've come to learn.
Puffery means a kind of harmless lie, or you can say this is the greatest hot dog on Broadway. And you can also say this is the Trump Soho when it's not in Soho. What you can't do is lie about something that's materially important to the sale of a security or condo. So the question really was, the defense said, look, the building is built. The condos are there. This isn't some swampland in Florida. Where's the fraud here? And everybody got their money back, or the money was in escrow. So nobody's out a lot of money. No harm, no foul, no crime. That's what the defense is saying.
But, I mean, to me, as you guys said, saying 60% were sold when 15% were sold, this clearly feels like it crosses the line.
Well, we know that a lot of people in the Manhattan DA's office thought so, too. But there's another problem that gets introduced, which is that the civil suit is settled, and the buyers get 90% of their deposits back, but the Trumps get something, too. What the Trumps get is a promise by the victims that they won't cooperate with prosecutors.
So, willingly.
Is that legal? Are you allowed to ask somebody not to participate in a criminal prosecution?
Well, this gets to whether the DA was aggressive enough, because the DA could have put pressure on them to rescind this.
And this is the point where the defense team starts to escalate into the spring of 2012, when we now know the Manhattan DA's office was seriously considering impaneling a special grand jury. So that's a big deal, because when you get to a special grand jury, the likelihood is that the next step is indictment.
All right. And this is the moment in the story where in comes Mark Kasowitz. Explain who Mark Kasowitz is.
Mark Kasowitz is a civil attorney who represents corporations mostly, and at this point has represented Donald Trump personally for about a decade.
And still does.
And still does today.
So confusing why at this key moment they have an all-star criminal defense team, they're about to face a possible grand jury, and they go with a civil guy.
Right. So the Trump Organization adds Mark Kasowitz to the team, and Kasowitz goes straight to Vance.
You mean Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney?
Correct.
And Kasowitz has a connection to Vance.
So Kasowitz has made a contribution to Vance. He's made a $25,000 contribution in January of 2012. So just to place that in time, the civil suit is settled in November 2011. Kasowitz makes a $25,000 contribution in January. In May is the meeting with Vance.
And just to be clear, the Manhattan DA runs for election to become the Manhattan
right.
DA.
Oh,
yes, he's running for his reelection. Kasowitz is now in the top donors of Cy Vance. So he calls up Cy Vance in the beginning of May, and he says, can I have this meeting?
Jesse, you talked to Cy Vance about this?
Yeah, we both, Andrea and I both did.
Thankfully, I have a sort of a vetting process and a vetting team, and the fact that he had contributed previously before he had said he was coming into the litigation, and a decision was made to return the $25,000 simply to avoid any appearance of, you know, of conflict.
So he returned the contribution. So it was okay to meet with Kasowitz. Then, 3 months later, Vance closes the case.
At the end of the day, I did not believe that we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime had been committed. I was not sure that I knew that a crime had been committed. After 24 months, I felt that we had to bring the inquiry to a close and I had to make a call.
But what our reporting shows is that there was a generalized belief up and down the DA's office, right up to the level of Cy Vance, that they should proceed forward with this prosecution.
The line prosecutors did believe there was a crime committed, right?
There was debate, I think discussion and analysis in the office about whether or not a crime had been committed and whether or not it should be charged as a crime.
Was there somebody strongly against bringing the case?
And we can't go into all the deliberative process. We have great lawyers. I respect them. But at the end of the day, I have to look at all the evidence and weigh all the factors as the lead of the office, and my name's on the indictment as to whether or not I feel this should be prosecuted as a crime. Not every lie is a crime.
Yeah, so he overruled the rest of the office.
And let's just say in his heart of hearts, we take him at his word, he just didn't think this was the right case to bring. Wouldn't he know it looks bad that his number one donor or one of his top donors had met with him to recommend that he stop this case, and then he stops the case?
A month after Vance closes the case, Kasowitz gets back in touch and says, I'd like to hold a fundraiser. And Kasowitz does hold a fundraiser in January of 2013. So this is 5 months after the case has been closed. And he gives an even bigger donation to Vance, almost $32,000 this time. And over the course of the next year, he raises $50,000, effectively doubling his initial contribution.
So this looks terrible. not knowing Vance's thought process, this looks awful.
Vance argued strongly that he made the decision on the merits and that he was uninfluenced by Kasowitz. And by the way, Kasowitz says the same thing. He said he made a donation because he respects Cy Vance. He respects his work.
I actually have Kasowitz's exact words here.
Yes, very Trumpian. I was.
Yeah. I donated to Cy Vance's campaign because I was and remain extremely impressed by him as a person of impeccable integrity, as a brilliant lawyer, and as a public servant with creative ideas and tremendous ability. I have never made a contribution to anyone's campaign, including Cy Vance's, as a quid pro quo for anything. That was an email Mark Kasowitz sent to us. So the timing of this second Kasowitz contribution really is confusing to me. I mean, it makes total sense that I think it's insane that the Manhattan DA is soliciting contributions from defense lawyers at all, but saying, okay, but I don't take any money from anyone who has a case before me, it seems even more so, or whose case has been dropped by me recently. That seems like a crucial...
We asked him about that.
It would not be wise to take a donation 24 hours after a case is concluded with a determination not to prosecute. I think that's obvious. 5.5 months is a whole different matter, and it seems to me a reasonable amount of time.
Is it 3 months? Where's the line where it becomes acceptable?
The line, I think, there is no bright line, Jesse, but I think the line is drawn by practice. The practice is the four step of the vetting process. And if those in the vetting process who had looked at this Kasowitz donation felt it was inappropriate at that time, I think they would have told me. That's not what happened. And look, I think having the issue of that second donation has not been an issue, as far as I knew, and wasn't an issue in my vetting team's or my office's mind until several weeks ago. But I'm perfectly happy to return that money either to Mark or to some appropriate criminal justice organization, because the money isn't that significant to me, and I don't want the money to be a millstone around anybody's neck, including the office. But it was not flagged internally as something that should be returned, I completely understand the interest that you have in sort of the TikTok and who said what when, and feel the smart thing to do is to either return it to Mark or to some charity.
So that's his argument.
Right.
We're not alone in thinking that this was questionable. Paul Grand, who we spoke of earlier, Grand is representing one of the brokers, said to us that this meeting, quote, didn't have an air you'd like. And he said, if you or I were the district attorney and a guy comes in out of the blue and wants to meet with you and he's a campaign donor and the other two lawyers are nowhere to be seen, you would think twice about it. So Paul Grand himself thought this was the right decision made in a questionable fashion.
Wow.
The coda is that Kasowitz goes around now telling people that he's the one that saved Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. from a really dangerous investigation.
Kasowitz denies ever saying anything like that, by the way.
And if you think, imagine the counterfactual here that Ivanka and Donald Trump had been charged, the world would be a different place.
It seems unlikely that Trump would have been able to run for president or would have chosen to.
I think it would have been impossible with two indicted children on his own big marquee project.
That's Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica, along with Andrea Bernstein of the WNYC Newsroom. They spoke with The New Yorker's Adam Davidson. As of today, just over 30% of the units in the Trump Soho have sold. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Doreen St. Felix became a New Yorker staff writer earlier this year, and she's written on subjects ranging from Justin Bieber to gentrification to the racial politics of The Bachelorette. She's been singing the praises of a rapper named Cardi B, and I asked Doreen to come by and tell me about that and a couple of other things she's been into these days.
So, Doreen, I just want to get clued into what you're thinking about and looking at and hearing these days, and I have a premonition that one of the things might be something that you wrote about recently.
Yes. So Cardi B recently became the second female solo rapper in history to hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart.
Who was first?
Lauryn Hill.
There you go.
And that was in 1998.
So of those two people, I've at least seen one live.
I'm guessing it's Lauryn Hill.
Yeah, that's, you got it. What should we hear from Cardi B?
We should listen to Bodak Yellow. Bitch, I make bloody moves. Now she say she gon' do what or who? Let's find out and see. Cardi B, you know where I'm at. You know where I be. You run the club just to party. I'm there, I get paid a fee. I be in and out them banks so much I know they tired of me.
We can get about 40% of this on the radio.
So Cardi B is from the South Bronx, and she is really interesting because she did not become famous as a musician. She became famous on Instagram and Vine in 2013, early 2014.
Why?
At first, she was just another girl who was making funny videos that people used as memes, as response gifs, that kind of thing. But then she actually started building her own following, and that's because she's just a miracle of streaming. Hmm. Bodak Yellow was supposed to introduce us to Cardi B,
right.
But it ended up being a blockbuster. It's the music story of the year. I think that a lot of industry people aren't sure of how to integrate streaming into the way that we understand what listeners are into. But Cardi B has shown us that's where the money is, and that's how you create a community of people who are willing to, you know, build your profile in a way that is nearly unprecedented, I'd say. Get what he want, he buy me East and LeBron, and then you rip, when
I go fast as a horse, I got the trunk in the front, I'm the hottest. So now we make a rapid transition from Cardi B to what? What else? What's been on?
We should
on
talk
your
about
mind?
Chopped Junior.
Oh, my wife loves this.
Oh, she does.
Oh, my God. Oh, my
so
God.
So maybe you know a little bit about
I
what
give
we'll
her
talk
a slightly
about.
Despairing look when I see her watching it, I have to admit.
So Chopped Junior has the same premise as the original Chopped, which is to say there are three rounds in which four contestants have to make an appetizer, a main, and a dessert from four random ingredients.
No, it's like chili peppers, vanilla ice cream,
exactly.
A hot dog, and something else.
Yeah, and like yeah. Sardines.
Yeah.
But Chopped Junior features contestants as young as nine.
And you must use paneer cheese.
Paneer cheese, what?
It's just so soothing to watch nine-year-olds screw up. That's the thing, though. They're phenomenally...
Nine-year-olds are sous-viding
things? Yes, they're phenomenally able. They're not at all scared of using all of these like really fancy appliances in the kitchen. And sometimes the food looks good. Not all the time.
What do they make?
Well, there's a really great example of this girl using a lollipop and melting it down with water to make a kind of savory sweet sauce.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna crush up the apple candies and put them in a pan. And I'm adding mint to the dish because it'll add a light herbiness to it. Dulce de leche. Yeah,
so. Lollipop reduction.
Yes, exactly.
Drizzled lollipop reduction. I'm guessing after a long night of watching Chopped, you have other things on your mind. What would be your third pick?
So I was in New Orleans this past weekend, and while I was there, I was walking down this beautiful tree-lined block, and I saw this home, and it had flags on it, and I wondered, like, what is happening? And in front of it, I saw a plaque, and it actually explained that Edgar Degas lived in that home for 5 months between the fall of 1872 and the beginning of 1873.
Wow.
Yeah, so he actually is part American. His mother was a French Creole. Her name was Celestine. And she lived in New Orleans before she moved to France. And Degas did not make much of a splash as an artist in France. And then he went to New Orleans, where two of his brothers were living. And he absolutely fell in love with the city. He started calling himself a son of Louisiana. And he has this really famous painting called A Cotton Office in New Orleans, which you can see here. And it actually features his uncle and two of his brothers. That's one of his brothers right there.
Reading a newspaper.
Yeah, he's reading the Daily Picayune. And his uncle was very wealthy through the cotton trade. And what's so interesting about this painting is it captures a culture in decline. So these French Creoles, you know, they still spoke French. They didn't really want to think of New Orleans as being an American city at that point. And not long after this, his uncle's business collapsed and New Orleans ends up becoming the city that we're more familiar with today.
And this is after Emancipation Proclamation.
Exactly.
So it's a political painting,
yes,
as well as a family one. It's an amazing thing. I've never seen it other than reproduced. It's a beautiful picture.
Yeah. And, now,
and you just happened upon it walking down the street.
I just happened upon it. I mean, it's a perfect New Orleans story. And it actually is a bed and breakfast now.
Perfect. And you could have had lollipop reduction on your
my Creole omelet.
Exactly. Doreen, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Doreen St. Felix's writing on, among other things, competitive double Dutch jump roping at newyorkerradio.org. And that's it for right now. We'll be back soon with more from the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.